conflict.
Today is February 23rd, 2017. This is Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services. Today is a continuation on the public hearing for House Bill 5026, and we're going into a hospital assessment briefing. And we have Director Coyner, I believe, is going to kick us off this morning.
Shall I introduce?
Please, Ms. Ames. I apologize.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just a little introduction for today. Today is an introduction to the provider taxes in general and the hospital assessment specifically. This is a large other fund source of revenue for the health plan. So one goal today is to understand this funding mechanism, how it works, its budget impact. And I will confess, for the first several years I worked on this budget, every time I would sit down with Janelle to discuss this topic, I would start with, "I'm really sorry, Janelle, but I just don't get this yet." So don't feel too frustrated if in your first round it isn't all completely clear. But the other goal today is more generally the budget context, now that we're 3 years into the ACA and given our current budget situation. The ACA changed the healthcare landscape very significantly. It brought 400,000 people onto the health plan. That's 10% of our population. And it reduced the uninsured population from around 15% down to 5%. The federal government paid the cost for those first 3 years, providing federal resources of about $2.5 billion a year. Now that the state is required to pick up a portion of the costs, we need to look at the system more broadly to understand who's benefited from the ACA, as well as the state budget impact that we've been talking about. And then just to warn you, we do have two grant requests towards the end of the hearing.
Thank you very much. Director Coyner, whenever you're ready.
Good morning. For the record, this is Lori Coyner, State Medicaid Director from the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm going to have my colleagues introduce themselves, and then we'll go ahead and get started.
Excellent. Thank you, Lori. This is Kate Nass. For the record, I am the Deputy Director of Finance at the Oregon Health Authority.
And I'm Janelle Evans, Budget Director for the Oregon Health Authority.
Chairs and members of the committee, we have a number of slides developed, but we, as Linda mentioned, this is a complex topic, and so rather than waiting for questions at the end, I think it might be most fruitful that if you have questions while we're talking, stop us and ask so that we can have a dialogue, so that when you walk out that you understand, at least at a high level, how the hospital assessment works. And I think Kate's going to go ahead and get started.
Excellent. Thank you. So just really quick, just to kind of cover the intent, we were asked to come and kind of speak at a high level, give a summary of what provider tax looks like. So generally, how we use the provider tax to help fund our Oregon health plan. So we'll talk briefly about kind of refresh what the health plan budget looks like, how it's funded right now, how Oregon uses provider taxes, what federal requirements or restrictions are in place around provider taxes, some of the history around the Oregon's program, and then we'll present kind of walking through at a high level of how Oregon's hospital provider tax works. And then lastly, we'll close up with a few slides that talk about kind of the financial picture for Oregon hospitals right now. So just for grounding, a provider tax is a, in the healthcare arena, is a tax assessment or fee on a healthcare provider, which is then taken as state revenue and used to pull down federal match. And typically, that then goes back into the program that is matched with the Medicaid money to kind of make the provider whole and they're not harmed.
So I'll talk about a little bit how the Oregon Health Plan is funded. On this slide is a historical chart. We actually walked through this one a couple weeks ago, but I want to refresh your memory on this. So starting back in 2007-09 biennium, the total program for the Oregon Health Plan Medicaid budget was $4.2 billion. $896 million of that was general funds, which is 21%. The line across the top is the caseload. So in 07-09, we had a caseload of about 400,000 people. If we jump ahead a couple years, our caseload grew to about 600,000. Our total was $6.8 billion. Our general funds were almost back to the 709 level at $853 million, which was 12% of the total budget. Advance another couple biennium. Current biennium 2015-17, we are at 1.1 million in our caseload. Our total is 14.8 billion. Our general funds are 1.1 billion at 7.6% general funds. And in 17-19, you'll note that our total caseload has come down slightly to just over a million, and our total funds has decreased slightly to 14.6 billion. General funds being 1.1 at 8.2%. Highlighted there in the green section across there, that is the provider tax portion of the funding. And it also includes the hospital assessment as well as the managed care and insurers tax for most of those biennia. The insurers and managed care taxes started in 2004 and went through 2013. And the governor's budget in 2017-19 proposes an insurer's tax as well. So those funds are all included in the green there.
Mr. Chair,
please,
just for some context, the actual negotiation and the beginning of the provider assessment was done in 2003 because I negotiated that with the hospitals. We were in a crisis with funding for the Oregon Health Plan during that period of history like we are today. And so there was serious when we found the ability to leverage state dollars with federal dollars, that became the actual impetus for what we're doing today.
This next one shows our total funding by fund type. The 14.8 billion you see on the right is our total. We're going to be concentrating on the blue. Blue section is our state funding. It breaks down into just about a third, a little over a third is general funds, a third is other state funding, and just under a third is the hospital assessment program. Our slides going forward will be concentrating on that program. That generates the revenue for the hospital assessment program.
Janelle, can I add something? So one thing to point out is the federal dollars are in this, in the big donut, are 77%. And so that's an aggregate between the expansion population that's covered at a much higher proportion and our more traditional Medicaid that's covered around at 64%. And so when we put it together overall, in the overall budget, it's 77%, just to help people understand why you're seeing a 77% proportion for federal dollars.
All right, so I'll go briefly into how Oregon is currently using provider services. Oregon currently has the two, one on inpatient hospital revenue and one on long-term care and nursing facilities. The hospital assessment provides funding for the Oregon Health Plan, offsetting general fund need in that program, as well as for funding that's for hospital programs and initiatives. There's an average biennial rate for the current biennium of around 5.5%. That is on the what's called DRG hospitals or diagnostic related groups. Just for a quick note, DRG is a classification for Medicare reimbursement, and basically just means that the large and urban hospitals are the ones that are taxed. And then the second one that we have is the long-term care facility tax. I just wanted to note that we had two. That helps support the nursing facility program within the Department of Human Services, aging and people with disabilities.
Representative Malmstrom.
Thank you, Chair. Co-chair. Quick question with the DRG hospitals, urban ones. Can you define who those are? Are we talking just about, you know, the big five, or are we talking about 14 or 15, or what are we talking about here?
Yeah, actually, on the next slide, I go into that. Thank you, Representative Malmstrom. Members of the committee, there's 28 DRG hospitals out of the 60 acute, and they are the larger urban ones. Then we also have our the rural and smaller hospitals that are not taxed.
Okay, thank you.
So 28 of the 60 are in the DRG classification.
You might want to explain that there's no option. You either have them all, or so you might want to explain that federal requirement.
Thank you, Senator Winters. I think Lori might go into that a little bit later, but yeah, you're right. We kind of have to uniformly assess.
And Senator Winters, some of the federal requirements are later in the presentation.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. So, excellent point. Thank you, Senator Winters. So on the next slide, just wanted to note, similar, Senator Winters is ahead of me. The hospital assessment program was originally created in 2003. This generated revenue for the Oregon Health Plan. It expanded coverage and also increased hospital reimbursement levels. So, and again, to Representative Malmstrom's question, there's the 28 DRG hospitals that are participating in the program, and the small and rural hospitals are not.
Chairs and members of the committee, I'm going to talk a little bit about what the requirements are from the federal government, and Senator Winters already mentioned one of the rules for implementing provider taxes, and then show you what other states are doing. I do want to point out that when we talk about the DRG hospitals, those 28, they do exist in some, they're not all Portland Metro, so there are DRG hospitals there's one in Salem, for example, or in Eugene, so there and Corvallis, yes. And the more rural parts of the state are the smaller hospitals, which we often call critical access. So they are scaled down in terms of what services they provide often, and provide important emergency and critical access services for members in their community. They have fewer beds, and so they are not assessed. And that's important because in federal rule, as Senator Winters pointed out, we have to, if we implement or any state implements a provider tax, it has to be uniform across, a group of providers. And so in our case, it's DRG hospitals, and so we can't pick and choose and just say, oh, a certain number of those DRG hospitals are going to have a provider assessment. If we're going to implement it, it's got to be across the entire DRG set. The other point is that the federal rule allows states to have provider assessments on a host of different providers. We aren't going to provide the list, I think, in slides, but there's categories that exist beyond just hospitals, insurers, and in our case, nursing facilities. And so you'll see on the next slide when we move there that states have multiple provider assessment programs. The tax program must not violate the hold harmless provisions. And what this means is that the state cannot guarantee that the taxpaying entity will receive increased Medicaid funding. So we have rules around what can happen in terms of once those dollars are paid, and if there's a payback in terms of Medicaid expenditures, there's rules around how that happens. I don't know if we stress this enough, but the reason that what we do with our provider assessment dollars here in the state is use that to get federal match dollars. I mean, that's really the key important area. So, in fact, if you can go back to the donut picture. So when you look at the total state funding in OHP, that The blue donut is what is the collection of dollars that we put together as a state to receive federal match dollars. So the state isn't eligible for matching funds unless we put some money up front. And so the hospital assessment allows us to put money up front to get matching dollars. And therefore, there are quite a few federal regulations around how you do that. And one thing that you're not allowed to do is have the money come up front, get matching dollars, and then tell, oh, those hospitals, we're going to give you better Medicaid rates than everybody else. And that would be violation of the hold harmless provision. So if we go back. In our current program, there's a cap on what we can assess, and that's 6%. If we do choose to go above 6% for hospitals, there's a whole host of additional restrictions around it. And such as there's a more stringent hold harmless test. Next slide. So here's the state, here's the map of the U.S. Alaska is the only state that doesn't have some at least one provider assessment. The lightest blue colors have just one provider tax. I believe that's six states. The turquoise blue have two provider taxes, and then all of the dark blue have three or more. So you can see, a number of states do have multiple provider taxes.
Oh, please, Representative Malmstrom.
I'm just curious. So Oregon has the hospital one and the long-term facility one. What is the ones that have three? What are they doing for their third one?
Representative Malmstrom and members of the committee, the an example is insurer tax. So in our in the governor's budget currently, there and what we have had in the past is a tax on insurers. And I don't know, Kate, do you?
Representative Malmstrom, members of the committee, the three most common in the states are the nursing facilities or the long-term care one that we have, the hospital inpatient, as well as the intermediate care facilities for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Those are the three most common, but there is 19 or 20 different ones, so it just depends what mix each state has.
Thank you.
And then I had a quick question, Director Koerner. And when we talk about some of the rules for, the federal rules that you have to have, it says uniformly imposed. I've heard, like in California, that they have different thresholds of the tax, imposed over, for instance, all of the, their insurance plans. So whether it's private insurance plans or under a certain rate, and then as you get into kind of like their CCOs, they have higher rates. That to me, like mentally, doesn't seem uniformly imposed.
Representative Rayfield, I'm not familiar with the California model, though I do know, for example, with their hospital system, they have devoted public hospitals that are usually county-based that serve the bulk of their Medicaid beneficiaries. You can do is kind of assess a rate for a class and then have another rate for another class. So an example in our state would be, and I'm not proposing this at all, I'm just using it as an example, but if our DRG hospitals, there's the critical access hospitals, you could do, if you did a tiered assessment, then it's by class and it would be uniform across all. Does that make sense?
It does make sense.
So I'm going to go through on the next slide a little bit more on the mechanics of how the program works. So the DRG or the large hospitals are assessed on their net patient revenue. Net patient revenue is calculated taking their total revenue, less the uncompensated care, and less contractual amounts. When you get that net patient revenue, you take that times the tax rate, and that creates our state fund revenue that we use to match with the federal Medicaid.
Can you define contractual amounts?
Yeah, Representative Rayfield, thank you. It's basically third-party payer. So net patient revenue is essentially what the hospital believes they will collect. So by the time they have other third-party contractual allowances as well as the uncompensated care.
Okay.
If you want further, we can try to provide that too.
Representative Alonso-Leon. So the contractual amounts, do they actually get that amount? Or is that kind of an estimate of what they're hoping to get?
So Representative Wazzaleon, I believe it's adjusted as they as net patient revenue is realized. So, you know, they can go back and adjust for accounting reasons, am I correct? Like, so they'll, if a contractual amount, they do end up collecting it, they can adjust their net patient revenue in the next collection cycle.
And maybe if you could give us an example.
Yeah.
I guess I, actually, now that you've talked about it further, yeah, that's a little bit of confusion.
Yeah, Representative Rayfield, I don't have a specific example on top of my head right now, sorry, but we can come back with one if that helps, and how that kind of, how we adjust, for how net patient revenue can be adjusted depending on the contractual amounts and what the hospital is realizing financially.
That would be helpful. Thank you.
Thanks.
I can probably answer that, Representative Rayfield. Yeah. So let me give you an example. If an insurance company pays for a patient to the hospital, and then so they have all of those insurance claims, then if they have contracted providers, for example, there's a provider group that provides services to the hospital but it's not part of the hospital, and you have to pay those professional fees out to those providers, and that wouldn't end up being a patient revenue for the hospital.
Okay, that makes sense.
So that's why it would be a contractual arrangement.
That makes sense. Thank you.
So when we have the net patient revenue, we use that to get the match for the federal match to get a total fund amount. The funds that we use the funds for the program, it does go to help fund the Oregon Health Plan, and it also goes to pay for additional hospital programs. These include the enhanced payments to help so that they can make the tax payment, and additional rate amounts. These program funds to help pay for the disproportionate share program, the graduate medical education program, and the hospital transformation performance program. So in aggregate, hospitals receive...
Representative Malmstrom.
Sorry to keep you interrupting, but I need to give a few little clarifications here. Can you describe what the disproportionate hospital share program is? I have an idea what graduate medical education program has been, and all these different things. Can you explain them a little more? And then also, are these suggested things, or do you need to do a certain amount to these things? How does that work?
So
start on the dish and I.
Okay, so the disproportionate share program is a federal program that allows additional Medicaid funding for hospitals that are higher users for Medicaid.
Frequent flyer people is what you're talking about.
Representative Malmstrom and members of the committee, there is a federal allowance so that when we receive the hospital assessment dollars, and then some hospitals have a higher proportion of inpatient stays from Medicaid, and so there's a way to provide them additional dollars to cover the fact that they're having a larger population of Medicaid. It's not necessarily frequent flyers. Sometimes it can be where that hospital sits in terms of geography.
Right.
And the other programs, these are all... the graduate medical education program, supports graduate medical education for our state. And then finally, the hospital transformation performance program is a quality and access metric-based program. The hospitals have to meet benchmarks on, I think it's 12 quality metrics to receive the funding for that program.
And how about the first bullet?
The hospital enhanced payments and rates. I'll let Janelle talk a little bit more about how that functionally happens, but the idea is that it provides dollars back to the hospitals for putting the money up front for us to get federal match.
Wait, can I get the clarification on that?
Yeah, Representative Wazzaleon.
So they're going to get additional dollars for getting assessed?
Representative Alonzo Leon and members of the committee. To some degree, yes, and we will walk through, I think the next slide will, we have a flow chart that shows how the dollars move that I think might help in thinking about this. But you are right in the sense that they provide tax assessment dollars, we get federal match, and then those dollars that we receive from the hospitals are used to go to some programs and then also used to provide fees back to the hospitals.
And just a quick question on the disproportionate share hospital program, just to make you know, that is that being there's an assessment of your percentage or your mixture of Medicaid population within, and then that floats. So is that reimbursement rate going to differ between each hospital?
Yes, Chair Rayfield, it does vary by hospital based on their Medicaid experience.
Okay. And is this does that money only go back to DRGs, or does it go back to all A and Bs and kind of like maybe look at the various programs and which ones are going to which hospitals? I think that might be helpful for the group to understand.
Okay, so we have, Chair Rayfield, we have, there's actually several DISH programs within it. We have a total that we have, federal cap, but we have several DISH programs. The last one is our what we call our DISH 3 program, and it does benefit every hospital in the state, including AMBs.
And if you could go through and kind of maybe talk about them individually or?
Each of the programs?
Yeah, that'd be helpful.
I'm not an expert on this, but I will certainly try. The first part is what part of the DISH program goes to, no?
Is that what you mean? Every DISH, or do you mean just these four?
Well, actually, I was, yeah, everything.
Oh, okay.
And the dishes, yeah. and which hospitals they go to, because I think that's an important part of, you know. Yeah.
Actually, it's quite a lot of detail. Would it be okay if we got that back to you in writing so I could tell you kind of a little bit more about each of those?
Too complicated to
explain. Okay, and then maybe if you summarize which one of these go to which hospitals in the categories, and then we can move on.
Okay, so thank you, Chair Rayfield. The enhanced payments and rates go to the DRG hospitals. The disproportionate share program a little bit goes to every hospital, some more than others. In the graduate medical education program, I believe that all goes to OHSU, and the hospital transformation performance program goes to the DRG hospitals.
Yes, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Co-Chair Rayfield. Looking at these numbers, I've got to ask, it looks like that we're at 5.5% in hospital assessment. It looks like that every point, you know, like 0.1% or 0.1% equals about $180 million, which translates into $730 million from federal drawdown, right? If we're at 5.5% and we can go to 6, why aren't we at 5.6% or 5.7%? Now that we have a much more stable population, I believe the reason that this was set at 5.5 because of these factor, the contractual amount factor was really unknown when that 5.5%, so they had to build cushion into it, which they've done, and it went up to 5.8 and it's been down to 5.3 and now it's at 5.5. We've got a stable population now. We've got history that we can look at. Why can't we just say, okay, this is now going to be 5.6 or 5.7, still having a cushion in there, but for every 0.1%, we draw down about $730 million. Total, if you add the states, their contribution to it.
And just kind of quickly, yep. We're just looking at this history, 0.5% is actually $66 million in general fund. So just
state
kind of
fund.
The
right.
State
yeah.
Fund, yeah. Yeah. So just kind of, so if you went to 6, you'd only get $66 million. But please go ahead and answer.
But more federal.
Yeah, but more federal, true.
Thank you, Co-Chair, Representative Hayden. We do monitor the tax rate. In our current agreement, it goes to the last bullet actually on this slide. the hospitals receive the entire amount back that they're taxed through the rates, and in aggregate, they get everything back that they're going to pay in tax. Mm-hmm. And we have to be able to do that with our current caseload and within our current rates. So that enhanced rate, it has a limit. And so we monitor that to make sure we can get the funding back to the hospitals for when they pay the tax. So it has to be equal or more than. And so that's why we're limited currently with where we are with the tax rate. It's actually currently at 5.3%. It's an average of 5.5 over the biennium because the first half of the biennium we're at 5.8. And we are working on looking at that. We may be raising it again here soon.
Okay. Where did you get that? Where did you get the point? Where did we get the calculation of the each percentage or half percentage of $66 million?
Yeah, that's in the, if you look at the 15% list of the cuts and you go down to where they estimate eliminating the hospital transformation portion of it, there's actually a 0.5, which then equals out in the budget to $66 million. So I can show you where that is.
Those numbers don't seem to add up in my head, but
yeah,
I mean, take your word for it.
So.
So this next slide is a flow chart to kind of break down the program into more detail. The first box shows the hospital net patient revenue at $19.2 billion times our average tax rate for 15-17 at 5.5%. This equals state funds collected of $1.1 billion. Then how we spend those funds. First, they're matched with federal funds, and that's the mechanism for pulling the Medicaid match. The $561 million, approximately 53% of those funds, go to the Oregon Health Plan. Approximately 75% of the services we pay for in the Oregon Health Plan are for non-hospital services. This would be your physicians, your pharmacy, for a couple examples. About 25% of the Oregon Health, approximately 25% of the Oregon Health Plan expenditures are reimbursement for hospital services. And then we have the additional hospital programs, which are state funded, $494 million of the hospital tax. Those are matched. These are all matched with the federal funds. In the totals at the bottom, the Oregon Health Plan. $1.6 billion is for a total for non-hospital services, and approximately $2.5 billion goes for hospital services. It's paid to the hospitals.
So is this where you're talking, where I asked the question, they're getting money back extra for being assessed? That's a lot of money.
Representative Alonso Leon and members of the committee. Yeah, this is the flow chart that I was talking about to show that there's multiple streams of dollars that flow through after we receive the tax to get the match. Then some goes to Oregon Health Plan, which then we pay for hospital services. And then there's also those additional hospital payments, which include what we were talking about. Can you go back? That additional hospital payment program box includes these four bulleted items: the enhanced payments and rates to make sure they get their entire amount back in aggregate, plus the DSH funds, just proportionate share hospital program funds, the graduate medical education programs, and the hospital transformation performance pool. Half of that goes to the hospitals. The other half right now goes to pay the quality pool for CCOs. Is that helpful?
Yeah. Yeah, they're still making out.
and I just wanted to just clarify on that. You know, we were looking at the governor's budget. They talked about eliminating it was the hospital transformation performance pool, which was a $66 million savings, at least when we were looking at that. And I think Linda's chomping at the bit. Or
no, I
didn't. Okay, okay.
Oh, I did the arithmetic.
Okay, yeah, and then when we look at it, which is my understanding is that is a 0.5% on the 5.5 tax rate. Yet if you use a 0.5% times the 19.2 billion, you get an actual $96 million different. Yeah, so I was kind of curious why the difference between the two.
Co-Chair Rayfield, the $66 million on the cut list, it is the net amount after we've paid back the tax, and so it's not actual revenue.
There we are.
That makes sense.
So there is a little calculation in there.
Okay, and then the only other, so the hospital transportation pool, after I've gone over this a lot of times, you know, what are some of the metrics they get paid back for? I just haven't, I've never asked that question.
Our Representative Brakefield and members of the committee, so half of the dollars that are, I'll just give you a little history lesson on this. So when we first got this approved by, it's in our waiver, actually, we had to do a waiver amendment to implement the program. And when we first started, there's a cap in the waiver of $150 million to get paid back to the hospitals. So the first 2 years of the program, they were paid out the $150 million, and then in our legislation, state legislation, it got cut in half, so that half the dollars go to the hospitals, and the other half now go to pay for the CCO quality pool. Not all of it, but to contribute. So they pay, the metrics include, there's two of the, remember when I talked to you about CAPS metrics a couple last week, those are self-reported survey. There's a hospital-based CAPS survey that goes out to people after they've been in the hospital. And so there's two metrics on that. One is if they received adequate discharge instructions, and the other one was whether or not the member received information about the medications that they're going home with. There's three patient safety metrics around treatment in the hospital around certain drugs. There's a hospital readmission metric. There's a metric on screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment for members who are in the emergency department. And that's a similar metric to a metric that we measure for CCOs. Another kind of hospital and CCO-like metric is actually both the CCOs and hospitals are held accountable for follow-up after hospitalization for a mental illness, and that's one where they need to work together. And there's another metric that was developed in our state around the emergency department notification program, and that's that if a member came into or a person came into the hospital, into the emergency department, whether they get credit if they notify that person's primary care provider. So those are the bulk of the metrics. I might be missing one or two.
And does the hospital transformation pool, does that get paid out every biennium, or meet the metrics, do you keep some of the money, or how does that work?
Yeah, Representative Brakefield and members of the committee, it's paid out annually. So starting this year, we got 1 year extension in the waiver. And so this year it will be on an annual basis. It used to be on the program ran on a federal fiscal year, which starts the 1st of October. And then the hospitals submit their metrics and all by March, and then they're paid in June. So on an annual basis, there's a $500,000 floor that they are paid for participating. Their payment, the way the payment distribution happens is fairly different than the CCOs. It's on domains. So the three patient safety domain metrics, if they need to meet benchmarks within those domains to get any payment. All the dollars are distributed. So if it's a domain that only a few hospitals we're successful on, they get all the dollars that were set aside for that domain. Sure. So the hospitals are not guaranteed dollars beyond the $500,000 for meeting their metrics. They have to perform to get the dollars. There's also, just by statute, a hospital metrics committee that determines what the metrics are and the benchmarks, and they meet frequently.
So, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, please, Senator.
So then to clarify, how much of the hospital transformation payments are based on our statute and how much are based on the waiver? Is it an intersection between the two?
Senator Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, the waiver reflects the legislation. So okay. What the timeline was, the legislation was passed, and then once we had that, we went to CMS and negotiated the waiver amendment. And then what we negotiated for this most recent waiver was a one-year extension of the program. After that, the CMS really pushed back for a number of reasons on the way that the program works, and a lot of it has to do with where they're moving nationally in terms of hospital quality programs. And they wanted, if we implement the program after this year, we're required to have the dollars go through the CCOs in some way.
Got it. Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Bueller.
Thank you, Chair. What are the barriers to increasing the tax rate to, say, 5.8%?
Representative Bueller and members of the committee, yes. And I'm going to let Janelle talk about them. It's complicated in that it has to do, like she was saying, with caseload and some rules in terms of how dollars get paid back. I do believe there are ways to increase it, but I'm going to have Janelle speak to some of the finer points of that.
Co-Chair, Representative Bueller. So we have an agreement now with the current program that the amount in total that we get to the hospitals has to at least equal how much they're paying in tax. And so we have to monitor how much we are able to do that, how much of the enhanced payments we are able to get out to the hospitals via because our rates and through our caseload. So the caseload has come down a little bit. We haven't been able to get quite as much total dollars out, so we had to lower the tax rate a little bit to 5.3. It's currently at 5.3.
What do you mean you couldn't get it out?
So to get federal match, it has to be tied to a rate, a CMS-approved rate. And so
yeah.
We pay our rates based on for their client. And so when our caseload comes down, the total dollars comes down as well that we pay out.
When you mean caseload, which then translate into less net patient revenue, is that what you're referring to?
It does end up, you know, in the net patient revenue, co-chair, but it's really a mechanism of our expenditures on the Oregon Health Plan expenditures that are tied to this program on the enhanced amount totals, that we make sure that we get the total out to the hospitals and that we don't tax them more than that amount.
So do the enhanced payment amounts fluctuate?
Thank you, Co-Chair. They do fluctuate based on our total expenditures.
Okay. And who sets the fluctuations, or how does that get determined?
Co-Chair, it's our payments are based on our clients. So in a fee-for-service realm, if one of our clients goes to a hospital and we pay their expenditure for that hospital, a portion of that expenditure is the enhanced portion. We capture those totals and estimate them for the future. Same within the CCO realm. For our members that are in the CCO, a portion of their cap rate every month is for this enhanced portion, so we calculate that. So on total, how much we are able to get out to the hospitals, we estimate that for the whole time period. We also estimate the net patient revenue, and the two need to come into sync.
Okay, that makes sense.
And I could, Mr. Chair,
please,
members of the subcommittee. So there's two pieces to this that I might not always be technically correct, but it's how I finally got it through my head that what makes this work the way it works. The first is that you can't pay rates to hospitals more than Medicare, basically. So you are limited in how much you can get out to hospitals through increasing a rate. And that's the federal rule. But the other thing is, we run this program by an agreement that basically says what we get is what we send out. It doesn't have to be run that way. It could be a true tax where the hospitals didn't get everything they paid. We have chosen not to run it that way in the past, ever, which is why we kind of refer to it as an assessment. But, thank you.
Question.
Oh, please.
Thank you. So we've been running some numbers here. I stand corrected on some of those numbers. It's a much smaller amount, but still.
Legislators with calculators.
bad deal. Last minute calculation. So, yeah, a much smaller amount, but we're still talking about a significant amount of dollars in that little realm of can we go, you know, a little bit higher, and that's a bigger discussion. But what we don't hear a lot about, and I don't believe any other states are doing it, what is those more stringent requirements if we break the 6% cap? If we moved up to like 5.8 or 5.9, then all of a sudden we broke it unintentionally, what would happen to the state?
Thank you, Representative Hayden. You're right. We don't know of any other states that are going above the 6%, so it's kind of one of those, until somebody does it, you don't really know how it works. But the rule is basically, and I can try to boil it down, but it's complicated. I've heard it referred to as the 75-75 rule. So basically 75% of the providers who pay the tax cannot receive 75% or more of their total costs back. So it's, and what they consider payments to those providers is a whole list. This is in federal regulation, is a whole list of payments, and then it ends with and any other payments. And so that's where it's really hard to model, because we don't know what that would look like in a definition, and no states, we don't know of a state that's approached this, so we don't even know how the conversation with CMS went.
Just follow us. So I know this gets complicated, but with the new concept of changing the medical loss ratio and taking some administrative funds out of the CCO's budget and putting it towards the community benefit provider concept, wouldn't that be a non-direct or non, I mean, doesn't that whole concept of community benefit capture that? I mean, because it's not coming directly back to the hospitals, it's going basically from the administration to the, I mean, we're kind of laying out to the community. Would that still be considered a direct reimbursement? I mean, because that's new in the waiver, so I'm wondering if we're already doing what might qualify for that.
I was just going to kind of openly ask. I was not aware of our waiver discussion changing how we were doing the provider tax program. And so I didn't know how the waiver impacted our provider tax program, so I wanted to just kind of...
Representative Hayden and members of the committee, the waiver does not change how our provider tax program works.
I agree with that. And
the community benefit dollars come directly from CCOs. I will let people know that the managed care rule... But the managed care rule that was implemented last spring has provisions in it around hospital payments, or payments that are made the way that we do, where the hospitals get paid back through the capitation rate that goes to CCOs. And pass-through payments have to start being reduced by 10% a year for the next 10 years, and so that there you no longer have it in 10 years. So the agency may have to, depending on how this all comes together next summer, then we may have to look at how we will make adjustments to the program to meet federal regulation. We haven't done that work yet, partly because we need to understand what our next biennial budget looks like. And but we aren't allowed, for example, to make any more payments, any higher payments than what we were making for this for our 2017 rates. That's kind of the what freeze date, as it were. And so there, and then we need to start ratcheting back.
Okay. Why don't we, I know we have a couple of grant requests we have to get to, and so we can maybe keep moving to make sure that we have time at the end for that. But one question that eventually, if we have time, that it would be great to answer is the long-term care facility tax, I am told, is fluctuated at the highest rate or something along those lines, and I was curious why they can do that with the long-term care facility tax.
Thank you, Representative Rayfield. The long-term care facility tax or the nursing facility tax kind of just operates in a different model. So we can get you a little bit more detail on how that model works, but essentially it's taxed and then it pays for it off, it maintains rates in that program for nursing facilities and then offsetting general fund need to maintain those rates. So I just want to, that's a totally different model. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard to say that this could operate, the hospital assessment program could operate the same way because it's just modeled differently. Okay. If you want a little bit more of a detail, we can.
Yeah, I think it'd be helpful. We can probably take that offline.
So. Yeah.
Representative Hayden and Representative Rayfield, here are some numbers that you can see if your calculators match.
Okay, thank you.
So this spreadsheet actually is the numbers from the flow chart, just in another format. Actually, in the interest of time, and because I know we want to get to some of the later slides, this is the same information, and I'd be happy to walk through it, but we might want to go ahead and move past this for the moment.
Yeah. That sounds good. Looks like there's no questions.
All right. So now we'll move into the kind of what the current fiscal picture is and the impacts on hospital financials. So how have kind of hospital financials changed over the past couple of years? So first of all, with the expansion of Medicaid and the implementation of the ACA in Oregon, there was obviously a significant impact to Oregonians receiving coverage. Linda alluded to this earlier on introducing this, our presentation. So we had a large number of people become covered, which then basically does have an impact on the healthcare industry's financial picture. So kind of both go hand in hand. So prior to the 2014 implementation and Medicaid expansion, approximately 15% of Oregonians were uninsured or without coverage, and now it's about 5%. So with that change, the payer mix of hospitals changed. So it used to be about 15% of the large hospitals' payer mix were charges from Medicaid, whereas now about 23% are charges. So they're seeing a different mix of charges or revenues coming from the different coverage because of that implementation. And then another key point that I think is kind of important is prior to ACA implementation, hospitals were experiencing increases in revenues and margins. However, uncompensated care was also increasing. Whereas after the implementation or the ACA expansion, uncompensated care started to decrease, and then that while revenues and margins continued to increase. So the next couple of slides are just showing a couple of charts. This is from data that's reported to OHA by the hospitals. The financials are showing positive trends. So on the left there, the operating revenue has increased 17% since 2013. So this is from 2013 to 2015. And then on the right, uncompensated care has dropped 65%. So at the high in 2013 across, and this is all the large urban hospitals, these are all DRGs. The high was almost $1.1 billion of uncompensated care, and then now, or in 2015, it was around $400 million or a little less. And so both of those have a positive impact on margins. So this slide shows the two margins in two ways. So you're going to see the same line, but one's displayed on a percentage basis and one's displayed on a dollar basis. So the margins have grown from 2013. And then the total margin or total income has grown from 391 391 in 2011 to 857. So, but if you go to 2013, it was 575 million to 857 million.
I just want to clarify. I know some of the hospitals, especially like in my area, are like kind of a full system, which incorporates like a CCO. They've got private medical facilities. Is this just the hospital, or is this kind of a system-wide?
Representative Rayfield and members of the committee, this is just hospitals.
Okay.
So the hospitals report data to the health authority, and then it comes directly from them.
Okay, so they will separate out those individual parts of their budget when this information is reported?
Yes, so these it may include some outpatient, but it would be direct hospital outpatient visits, so if someone had day surgery, but it's not going to include the CCO incomer.
Okay. Yes, Representative Maelstrom.
Just trying to get this in a very general sense. So because uncompensated care has significantly decreased, you're getting these dollars in, you're not having to go out to the uncompensated care, the money is saved, and it's being collected, and what's happening to this money?
Can we go back to the last one? Representative Maelstrom and members of the committee, the way I think about it and might be helpful is you'll see that decrease in uncompensated care, and you can think about uncompensated care is basically people who had no insurance that would come to the hospital. So now with the expansion, many more Oregonians have coverage, and so when they go to the hospital, they get the hospitals now receive payment.
Right.
So the expansion decreased uncompensated care, and if you show the next slide, and that resulted likely or at least contributed, can't say it was the cause, but contributed to the increase in margins. So we haven't what we get in terms of financial data from the hospitals is not their full books of business necessarily. We can see that they are making more profit.
Right. Yeah, that's what I just want to make sure I understood right. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Rayfield. We get a lot of reports and great reports from OHA on the emergency access to the emergency room with our compensated populations because we get that data through the CCOs and through the hospitals. But I haven't seen, maybe I just haven't found it, but I haven't seen something that compares the emergency room access on the non-compensated population. Where have we come, or have we been successful in that realm?
Representative Hayden and members of the committee, Kate's going to take a look. I don't know off the top of my head. I can say that emergency department use has decreased if you look at commercial also. Medicaid's had more striking reductions, likely through our incentive program, but it has been decreasing across the state. I'm not certain about uncompensated care. And Kate has some data here.
So, Representative Hayden, we'll get you the report that we have that has utilization trends as well. And so this is not something that I've dove into, but in looking at what we did, what we're reporting for quarter two 2016 is in the hospitals, the DRG hospitals, the ED utilization has increased slightly, but it's fluctuated fits and starts, I guess. I'm trying to think of the right word.
It has a seasonal trend.
Thank you. And then, but we can get you the exact data. I'm kind of looking at a line that goes a little bit like that.
So I guess maybe dive into this a little bit further. Like I guess I had been under the impression that the emergency department utilization was going down for at least certain populations, and you're saying that's staying the same? Because that was also conflicting with, in my head, I'm thinking as emergency usage goes down, you would expect to see revenue to somewhat offset for hospitals. So I'm just trying to understand that.
Representative Rayfield and members of the committee, I think, to be clear, our Medicaid members, the emergency department use has decreased about 40% since 2011. So it's a dramatic decrease. When we look at the graphs here that are included for uncompensated care, so people who are uninsured, we have not seen the same sort of decrease in emergency department use over time.
Okay, gotcha.
Does that
follow up? The reason I'm interested, and thank you for getting that to me, I think, maybe I'm wrong, that it could be a benchmark to kind of put some success around our community benefit, what we're doing out there in the community. If we're not measuring the uncompensated, the uninsured population of our community versus going to the hospital, wouldn't that be a good marker to judge how we're doing in the community on a kind of a community benefit idea of what we're doing out in the community outside of, here, you've got this piece of paper that says you have insurance? So it seems to me that that would be a significant benchmark to track the non-compensated, the non-insured person going to the emergency room versus what services they're getting in the community. So that's why I'm curious about that, and I don't know the answer.
Representative Hayden and members of the committee, we haven't looked at that closely, and maybe we can talk a little more offline.
Maybe the committee could take a moment and recognize Senator Gelzer. So.
Hello, it's nice to meet you all.
Are there any other?
I think you forgot to pick her up on your way.
I know. We could have carpooled, right?
I know. Got to tell you, teenagers, they can slow you down.
So, Chair?
Yes.
I just wanted to state, I guess, in layman's terms for me, more people are insured, hospitals are making a profit. In just super, like, basic layman's terms. In the way I see the margins and the way I see people being insured, hospitals are being able to actually make a profit from it. Is that my under just general basic layman's terms?
Representative Alonzo Leon, yeah, yes. Just to be clear, hospitals, there's always a little bit of margin that they've been making, but they've just seen an uptick since that.
Since 2011.
It sounds like more than an uptick, though.
From $391 million to $857
million. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Bueller.
2011 was a year of aberration just because of the downturn in the economy, so I'm not sure that's the right baseline number to use. And they're going to have to maintain some type of margin so that you can leverage that dollar to build the necessary capital infrastructure and maintain the facilities to serve a greater population. So you may see these margins decrease as they have to spend to increase the capacity.
Okay. But,
so it's certainly up. Nice to see what the next couple of years are as they, you know, it may be spent down too.
Okay.
Any other questions?
That we want to say thank you for letting us present.
Thank you guys.
Thank you guys.
Okay. So we'll go ahead at this time. We have two grants to hear. We'll go ahead and open up a work session for a federal grant for surveillance of hepatitis B and C. Ms. Ames.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you can come ahead and come up. The next is a request to apply for a federal grant that would provide $200,000 per year for 4 years to improve data collection around hepatitis B and C.
Good morning. Chair Steiner, Hayward and Rayfield and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Ann Thomas. I'm a public health physician in the and Communicable Disease Program of the Oregon Health Authority's Public Health Division. I am here today to request permission to apply for federal funding to improve surveillance for hepatitis B and C virus in Oregon. As was mentioned, the funding is up to $200,000 a year and for a total of $800,000 for 4 years. Communicable disease control is a priority of Oregon State Health Improvement Plan, and hep C is the second most commonly reported disease after chlamydia. Accurate surveillance is critical to prevent and control the spread and manage the long-term impact of infection. We initiated laboratory reporting for hepatitis C in 2005, and between then and 2015, 59,645 cases of chronic hep C infection were reported. The annual number of liver cancer cases in Oregon doubled between 2000 and 2012, with 47% of the liver cancer cases related to hep C in 2012. Oregon had nearly 800 hep C-related hospitalizations a year from 2008 to 2012, with 70% in persons aged 50 to 64 years of age. And the average annual charges totaled $21 million. Deaths from Hep C in Oregon have been rising steadily over the last decade, averaging more than 400 a year from 2009 to 2013. The Hep C mortality rate was 6 times higher than that of HIV in Oregon, and in 2013 was nearly twice the national average. We've also identified important racial disparities. Asians are 40 times more likely to be impacted by chronic hepatitis B than whites in Oregon, while American Indians and blacks are twice as likely to be diagnosed with chronic Hep C and to die from complications of Hep C as whites. The data I've just been rattling off were published in an OHA publication, Viral Hepatitis in Oregon, which was the product of a one-time grant from the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials in 2014. Currently, however, the Acute and Communicable Disease Program has no funding to devote to viral hepatitis surveillance. We propose to use this funding to improve surveillance for acute and chronic hepatitis B and C, and develop surveillance for perinatal hepatitis C. With resources to improve case finding and completeness of data collection for new cases of hepatitis B and C, we can develop a better understanding of current needs in transmission, identify communities that are at highest risk for outbreaks, and develop timely interventions such as screening. The epidemics of viral hepatitis, HIV, opioid misuse, and injection drug use are closely intertwined. And we plan to work closely with our colleagues in the Injury and Violence Prevention Program and with our HIV, STD, and TB program to provide data to communities that can be used to improve outreach to populations at risk, such as those who inject drugs. We'll also focus on reducing new infections in groups identified in our state profile at high risk, such as African Americans, American Indians, and persons who inject drugs. A second emphasis will be on tracking the long-term complications of viral hepatitis. By using additional data sources, such as hospital discharge data, Oregon's cancer registry, and vital records to track hospitalizations from cirrhosis, liver cancer related to hepatitis B and C, and deaths from hepatitis B and C, we can measure how well we are responding to the needs of Oregonians identified with chronic viral hepatitis. These data will help support and evaluate implementation of testing, treatment, and prevention services at the local and state level. The proposed staffing will include funding for 2 existing positions. The first position is a public health physician at 3% FTE, who oversees hepatitis surveillance efforts in the state and will serve as the principal investigator. That's me. The second existing position is a vacant epidemiologist position that we have that will serve as the epidemiologist for the project. And we'll evaluate the current epidemiology of hepatitis B and C through looking at our public health surveillance data and additional existing OHA data sets, such as the cancer registry, Medicaid data, vital records. And this position will provide technical assistance to local health departments for investigating cases and implementing control measures. Additionally, we plan to contract with the Multnomah County Health Department for a part-time epidemiologist to investigate cases of viral hepatitis through patient interview, chart review, and queries to clinics and hospitals. This funding opportunity does not require any maintenance of effort by the state, and there's no expectation that the state will fund these activities or the position at the end of the grant period. Thank you for this opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any of your questions.
Please, Senator Steingart.
Dr. Thomas, one of the things that's concerning is the recent reports about the significant rise in syphilis in this state. I know that you didn't mention that specifically, but it seems to me it kind of goes hand in hand with all the other STIs that you discussed, and the populations that are affected are similar. While this grant will be focusing on hepatitis, do you think that some of the interventions and tracking will also help you identify and intervene on some of the on the significant rise in syphilis, which has major long-term ramifications as well?
Exactly. Yeah, it's a very sobering problem. I think you're right. Again, this money is not specifically for other infections, but it's very clear that these things are all intertwined, and I think it can only help if we bring more attention and resources to the people at risk, and particularly with syphilis. These are opiate misuse, injection drug use, they're at risk for hepatitis and HIV, and I think developing systems, I mean, the goal of this is to identify the community at risk, and our injury program has done a great job. They have, if you've ever been on their website, they have this data dashboard where you can go to your county and choose a time period and find out how many hospitalizations have been for overdose and how many deaths there are. And we want to do something like that for hepatitis. But I think by finding these really high communities at risk can hopefully develop sort of a more multidisciplinary, holistic approach to dealing with these hard-to-reach populations, which are largely often in rural settings.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Are there other questions? All right, Mr. McDonald.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Rayfield and Steiner-Hayward, members of the committee. Tom McDonald, the Chief Financial Office, and we recommend approval of the request.
Ms. Ames.
An LFO recommends approval retroactively of the request to apply for a grant from CDC for $200,000 a year for 4 years to improve data collection related to hepatitis B and C.
And it would be an honor at this time to accept the motion from my esteemed colleague, co-chair Steiner-Hayward.
It's going to be a long year, folks. Mr. Chair, I move LFO's recommendation.
In an emphatic manner, Co-Chair Steiner-Hayward moves the LFO recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, is there any objection? Motion carries. And I'll go ahead and carry this to the full. We'll go ahead and close the work session, open a work session on the grant for supporting young parents. Ms. Ames.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, again, the agency is here to request permission to apply for this federal grant from the Department of Health and Human Services. This would be $1.5 million per year for 3 years to support expecting and parenting teens and quite young adults.
Ms. Wilcox, please.
Co-Chair Steiner-Hayward and Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, good morning. My name, for the record, is Kate Wilcox, manager of the Maternal and Child Health Section of the Oregon Health Authority's Public Health Division. I'm here to request approval for the Federal Department of Health and Human Services Office of Adolescent Health's grant entitled Support for Expecting and Parenting Teens, Women, Fathers, and Their Families. So just about everybody. The goal of their grant is, through collaboration with an institution of higher education, provide expectant and parenting teens, women, fathers, ages 16 to 24, and their families with a seamless system of supportive services, including evidence-based and evidence-informed approaches to improve their health and well-being and success in completing their educational goals. Oregon has chosen to work with community colleges. Nationally, 30% of community colleges students are parents. Only 33% of the students with children complete a certificate or degree program within 6 years of enrollment. 71% of all students are student parents are women. They face significant time demands, as we experience every morning, those of us with kids, with 56% of single parents devoting more than 30 hours per week to dependent care, and often have significant financial and challenges and graduate with more debt. While it is within the mission of the community college system to provide social services and employment assistance to their students, they are increasingly short on resources to develop a comprehensive system to fulfill this mission. So OHA proposes to support and work with 4 to 6 community colleges in Oregon. They will be required to develop and strengthen their system of student support services across 5 domains. And each domain has a menu of set focus areas to choose from. The domains include personal health, and some of the focus areas could include mental health, nutrition counseling, domestic violence prevention, child health, could include well-child visits, child care support, nutrition counseling. Independence, education, and employment could include mentorship, financial literacy, job readiness. Concrete supports, which could include transportation, housing, benefits such as SNAP, WIC, and TANF. And finally, parenting supports, so parenting education, stress management, and training in healthy relationships. A request for proposal process will determine which community college sites will be funded. In addition, OHA will be working with the Council of Student Services Administrators to find opportunities to strengthen the system of services across all 17 Oregon community colleges. The desired outcome is to anchor high-quality resources, programs, and services as a sustainable part of routine student service systems in the community college setting. This grant, as stated before, is a 3-year grant providing up to $1.5 million per year for a total of $4.5 million for the duration of the grant. Grant period is scheduled to start July 1st, 2017 through June 30th, 2020. It requires no state matching or maintenance of effort funds. However, the participating community colleges will be required to put forward a 25% match on their subaward, which can be in kind. So this grant will require no new positions. Rather, we will repurpose existing positions to manage the grant activities. Thank you, and I welcome your questions.
Thank you.
Yeah, Coach.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wilcox. Mm-hmm. Always a pleasure to see you. How are you going to track outcome measures on this?
Mm-hmm. Co-chairs and representatives, Senator Steiner Hayward, the outcomes will be measured by looking at what evidence-based practices they select around each of those focus areas. And so within the rubric of that evidence-based practice, there will be measures to measure the impact of that particular measure.
So basically, they'll depending on which ones they pick, but they will be required to use evidence-based practices?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Wallace-Leon.
I just wanted to say that this is an awesome idea. I used to work for a teen parent program and taught PE classes for teen moms, you know, who after they gave birth needed to get credit so that they could graduate from high school. And so anything that we can do to help our young parents get ahead and get through education, have all the skills that need to be successful, I think it's just such a great idea to support. So thank you for bringing this opportunity to us.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Master.
Thank you. I would just kind of chime in to what she said as well. I spent a couple of years being the nurse consultant for the Insights Teen Parent Program in Portland, and that was one of the big holes that we constantly saw was young women who wanted to go back to school and couldn't figure out how to do it. With the Oregon Promise, that's another tool. But we just need to do whatever we can to support these parents because, you know, they're raising our future generation, and all that we can do to help them, I think we should do.
All right. With that, Mr. McDonald.
Thank you again for the record. Tom McDonald with the Chief Financial Office, and we recommend approval of the request.
Ms. Ames.
Yeah. LFO recommends approval of the request to apply for a grant from the Department of Health and Human Services for $1.5 million per year for 3 years to support expectant and parenting teens and young adults.
Move LFO's recommendation.
In a show of undeniable, unwavering support. Co-Chair Steiner Hayward has moved the LFO recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? I'm seeing no objection. Motion carries. And
let me take that one.
I think because Senator Winters has been conspicuously absent, we should allow her the opportunity to speak in full.
Great plan.
Yeah,
we'll have I love to be that the carrier. Plan. Senator Winters can carry it.
Oh, with that, anything else, Ms. Ames? Okay, we'll go ahead and adjourn and see everybody Monday.